about 10 to 20% of patients after open heart surgery will require readmission.
Is there any difference between this patient and someone who's not had recent cardiac surgery?
Their mortality can be as high as 30%.
You really want to find out what type of surgery they had.
People start second-guessing themselves. These patients are a real challenge.
Welcome back to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. And as always, joining me on the podcast is Dr. John Greenwood, Dr. Peter W., and Dr. Rob Rodriguez. How are you guys this podcast?
Doing great. Enjoying fall weather in New Orleans. It's been delightful.
Doing great out here on the West Coast, other than these fires, which are actually really bad, and the air quality out here has been horrific. It's been a rough couple of weeks, but hopefully it'll improve over the next week or so.
Doing wonderful in Philadelphia, very lucky not having to deal with all that tragedy out in California. Definitely thinking about you guys out there, but was actually just down in Peter's stomping grounds, down in the wonderful New Orleans. Had a wonderful time with some friends, got to eat some great food, get some great weather, and just got back actually earlier today.
Outstanding. Well, Rob, our thoughts are certainly with you and everyone on the West Coast. The news and the images, and just it is such a tragedy with the wildfires. And it's certainly good to hear that they're coming under control, but a tremendous just loss of life along with property and a lot of devastation. It really is amazing to see all of the images. So, you know, our thoughts are once again with you. And as we're recording today, a little bit more tragedy, not to be on the downside of things, but another shooting outside of a hospital in Chicago. And it certainly brings home the violence and things that we all confront. And as we approach the holiday time here, certainly in the U.S. with Thanksgiving, it really reminds us of the importance of really being thankful for the ones around us, the family, and the things that matter most. And to us, one of those things that matter most is education, talking about the intersection of critical care and emergency medicine, talking about some important topics in the care of critically ill patients, whether it be in the ED or in the ICU. And we've got an awesome topic this month. And I'm going to turn things over to John to lead us through this discussion, because it really deals with his area of expertise where he works in terms of the cardiac surgery ICU. So, John, take it away.
Well, thanks, Mike. So I know in the emergency department, particularly in the literature, in reviews, hot topics are oftentimes related to medical illness. So sepsis, stroke, STEMIs. What we're now seeing is that across the country, there are a number of patients returning to our emergency department after having surgical procedures. And this, what we're going to particularly focus on, is the patient with a recent coronary artery bypass surgery. Now, there's a great article written by Alex Koifman, Britt Long, and Tim Moncrief. Now, the latter two are out of, I believe, UT Dallas. Tim is practicing down at University of Miami. They did a great review. It's a very extensive review of complications after cardiac surgery. But what we're going to focus on today are the top three surgical complications, or the most important cardiac surgical complications that a patient will present with after coronary artery bypass surgery. Now, the number of patients receiving bypass surgery isn't all that rare. In fact, there's over 200,000 bypass surgeries performed each year in the United States. Now, national guidelines and reporting pressures in particular have resulted in postoperative protocol development and implementation that's really designed to get patients out of the ICU and out of the hospital quickly. So it's not really all that common for a patient to have open heart surgery and be out of the hospital within 3 to 5 days. Now, that's wonderful for the patients, but certainly at times, if we start pushing the limits a little bit, we're going to see some complications, particularly returning to our emergency department. And in fact, about 10 to 20% of patients after open heart surgery will require readmission within the first 30 days of discharge. So right then and there, about 20,000 to 40,000 patients are coming back to our EDs after open heart surgery just within a week to 30 days. Now, there are many potential complications after major surgery, such as open heart surgery. Now, the three most common are postoperative infections, congestive heart failure, and pain control issues. And there are certainly a host of non-operative complications that include pneumonia, which is usually due to prolonged atelectasis and chest wall pain, that basically patients can't take a deep breath and expand their lungs. Venothromboembolism, particularly DVT, atrial fibrillation, and even delayed stroke and new renal dysfunction after surgery. So there's a ton of these potential complications, but certainly there's some surgical ones that the emergency physician must be looking out for, and it has to be on their radar. And with that in mind, I'm going to put out an important caveat here. And I think with most postoperative patients, particularly cardiac surgery patients who re-present within the first 1 to 3 months, it's a really good idea to get them on the phone early in their course of care. They really do want to be involved. And a very brief discussion can be invaluable to give you an idea of not only what's wrong with the patient, but also what other complications might have arisen during the surgery itself. And I know that patient handoff time, particularly in the immediate postoperative phase, is critical for the intensivist in knowing how to manage that patient. So it's important to know these operative details, and sometimes they can give you insight over the phone with just a 2-3 minute phone call. So as we've gone over the landscape of all the potential complications that can arise, let's dive into some of the specific high-risk complications that can present in the outpatient setting after surgery. So let's start with Peter. Peter, talk to us a little about infections are very common, but particularly sternal wound infections. What does the emergency physician have to know about sternal wound infections after cardiac surgery?
So this is a great setup, John. And so really, sternal wound infections are divided into two major groups, the superficial sternal wound infection group and then the deeper sternal wound infection group. When we talk about the superficial sternal wound infections, this is really the involvement of skin, some subcutaneous tissue. It could be some pectoralis major fascia, but it does not have bony or mediastinal involvement. It really is superficial layers. These occur in up to 8% of patients. So it is common, and this is something that we as emergency medicine clinicians will see. It can really often be treated with local IND by the surgical team and antibiotics. Now, understanding that, the second group is the deep sternal wound infections. They are a bit more rare, representing about 1% to 2% of patients, but these are serious complications, right? These patients typically have diabetes and have a greater risk associated with that. Their mortality can be as high as 30%. The clinical diagnosis can be identified in patients with sternal instability, fever, and really purulent discharge and drainage from the mediastinum. It can also be seen with positive wound cultures from the surgical site. The treatment here is to obtain really early on sternal wound cultures, and these patients don't get debrided in the ED. They go to the OR for debridement. They get big time washout and receive antibiotics. How do we differentiate something that may be smoldering? You think it's a tweener, it's not so superficial, maybe deep. We're going to get a CT scan of the chest with IV contrast. The most common organisms we wind up with methicillin sensitive Staph aureus 28% of the time. So that's the lion's share. This is followed by Pseudomonas 18% with a spike in those diabetic patients, MRSA 15%, and then the fourth will be Enterobacteriaceae species at about 7%. Our initial go-to antibiotics after, again, those sternal cultures, vancomycin, broad-spectrum beta-lactam, and we consider double coverage for Pseudomonas if we think that that's our greatest concern.
Excellent review, Peter. Thank you so much. You know, I agree that these deep sternal wound infections, while very uncommon, really carry a high risk of death, and these patients have to be on the lookout. Actually, as I think about it, I have a great video of a patient who had sternal dehiscence from a deep sternal wound infection. Mike, maybe I'll see if I can get some help from you in putting it up on the website as a little video file. It's a nice example of this rare but very serious complication. So as we move through from maybe the superficial to the musculoskeletal complications, Rob, I think these patients often go into the operating room. They have significant coronary artery disease. They're getting bypass grafts. What's the actual risk of these grafts going down? Is it all that common, something we should really worry about?
Yeah, Mike, this is one of the biggest concerns when evaluating a patient who presents after bypass, after CABG surgery. And the incidence is somewhat high. It's estimated to occur in about 5 to 14% of patients. And this most commonly occurs in the first 1 to 3 months after their surgery. Graft occlusion is much more common in patients who have vein grafts as compared to arterial grafts. And your evaluation of these patients really should follow your traditional history, physical exam, and of course, ECG, with a few notable caveats. In terms of the history, you really want to find out what type of surgery they had, whether they had saphenous vein grafts versus internal mammary artery type graft or other types of arterial grafts. That, of course, will affect, as mentioned, the incidence of graft failure. And you also want to try and find out, as you can from the patient's records or from, as you mentioned, discussing with their surgeon, what were the targets for their bypass. Graft failure is more common in LAD and left main grafts, and so they're particularly at risk. You also want to find out about their med compliance. Patients are typically prescribed daily aspirin, and in some cases Plavix if they're allergic to aspirin, and often they're given dual platelet therapy for up to about a year. And not taking their platelet medications increases their occlusion rate by over 50% at 30 days. So asking about med compliance is an important thing to do. In terms of your EKG, your interpretation is really exactly the same as patients who have native coronary arteries. You're going to look, of course, for ST elevations and ST depressions. But it is notable that you should really compare their EKG in these patients with their discharge EKG if you have that available. And be aware of ST elevation mimics. For example, pericarditis can be seen up to 3 weeks after their surgery. And this is a mimic of ST elevation, as well as left ventricular aneurysm, which may have occurred from an MI that they have had previous to their surgery. We also recommend early echocardiography for these patients to look for regional wall motion abnormalities, and that can sort of bolster your diagnosis of acute graft failure. But notably, in the event of a true occlusion, these patients should really go immediately to the cath lab and treat them as a STEMI. They're really at high risk, as mentioned before, and the best way to determine that is for them to get their arteries investigated.
Excellent pearls, Rob, particularly about that EKG interpretation. I think a lot of times once there's a surgery involved, people start second guessing themselves as to whether or not that EKG is surgically modified, if you will. But it is. It's exactly the same as what you would do as if that patient had no surgery at all. And also, the point about not taking aspirin, that's really impressive, that a 50% increase of risk at 30 days. Great, great pearls there. So we've got superficial wound infections. We have deep sternal wound infections. Obviously, we're worried about bypass graft occlusion. Now, Mike, is there anything else in that patient who comes in, let's say 2 weeks after surgery, they fast-tracked, everything went fine, but they roll into triage and, you know, they're feeling short of breath, a little bit tachycardic, anything else that would be on your radar in terms of potential problems that this patient might be kind of confronted with?
Well, now you got me thinking about a whole lot of things, John. If they're at risk for DVT, do they have a postoperative DVT and subsequent PE? Do they have graft occlusion? So now I'm getting my EKG. They've got this shortness of breath. They have maybe have some chest discomfort. So we're thinking about all the usual things that we would think of in a person, usually with comorbidities, getting a CABG, coming in now with these complaints. And often the diagnosis that we delay in making just because it isn't at the top of our radar, but this is a true can't miss, is pericardial fusion with resultant tamponade. These patients in particular are at very high risk for development of a pericardial fusion. In fact, when you look at the literature, up to 80% of these patients do have some pericardial fusion following surgery. Now, most are small, most are inconsequential, and these patients usually develop a fusion for several things. The result of pericardial inflammation, they could be having a slow mediastinal bleed postoperatively, or as Rob just went through, they are on antiplatelet and in many cases anticoagulant medications. So this has to rise high on the differential for any cardiac surgery patient returning to our ED with nonspecific or a variety of symptoms. Now, those that are going to come back and the effusion is not inconsequential, those that are going to be symptomatic are exactly what we would expect to have or see in a patient with a pericardial effusion, not postoperatively, but that shortness of breath with exertion. They may have fatigue. They may have some chest discomfort, perhaps a little bit of generalized nausea, a little less likely emesis. And importantly, on physical exam, you're going to see that tachycardia. They may be hypotensive, they may have distended neck veins, but also importantly, they're going to have clear breath sounds. Not the patient who's got valvular issues, they've got failure in their RALs all the way to the mid-lung fields or apices, but it's going to be complaints of shortness of breath, JVD, and then clear breath sounds. And I think as many emergency physicians and critical care physicians, really any acute care provider nowadays, many have training in bedside ultrasound. So an early clinical suspicion or a heightened clinical suspicion when they return to the ED, really bringing that ultrasound to the bedside following your initial history of present illness and exam and looking for the presence of a pericardial effusion. You know the signs well, so ventricular diastolic collapse, you'll see perhaps inferior vena cava, if you can get a good look, depending on the patient's body habitus, that'll be distended in addition to the right ventricular diastolic collapse, right atrial systolic collapse. But one important pearl is that in these patients, the effusion may not always be circumferential. So postoperatively, you really need to look all around in terms of the pericardium. There may be a clot secondary to the surgery, and it causes only the effusion to develop in a certain portion, limiting that venous return, causing inflow obstruction. So if you can't get great views and you have a high suspicion, you see something there, is it causing tamponade? Well, then you may need to move on with a TEE if you have that capability. You may need to get a formal TTE, depending on, once again, your resources, your location, the capability. Or in some cases, you could obtain a CT scan looking for the presence of a significant effusion. In addition, since these patients are postoperative, they've had a sternotomy, most cases they have a chest tube. Also be wary when you're performing your bedside ultrasound about the lack of lung sliding. They're going to have some shortness of breath when they come in. You're going to be thinking, could this be a pneumothorax? You're going to take a look, and the lack of lung sliding may mislead us. Some of these patients will ultimately have pleural adhesions following their bypass or open heart surgery, and they may not have that movement of the visceral over parietal pleura that we're used to seeing in non-surgical patients. Clearly, high suspicion, thinking about this, using your ultrasound and remembering it may not be a circumferential effusion and making that diagnosis. Once you have concerns or you've made the diagnosis of tamponade, certainly got to get them treated. And current guidelines would recommend getting them off back to the operating room for a re-sternotomy in that patient who looks moribund. They do have evidence of tamponade. Now, John, I'm going to turn this back to you. Because so many of these patients have a pericardial effusion, you're probably, of the four of us, going to see this most often with effusion causing tamponade. And let's just say it's the middle of the night. The surgical team may be in a case with a dissection and you've got signs of tamponade. You can't get them to the OR right away for a re-sternotomy. Are you going to perform a pericardiocentesis? And if so, is there any difference between this patient and someone who's not had recent cardiac surgery?
That's a great question, Mike. And I think the answer is absolutely, I would perform that pericardiocentesis. There actually is new guidelines out, particularly related to cardiac arrest after cardiac surgery. It's called CALS, C-A-L-S, that's most of the nursing staff are trained in. That's very similar to ACLS, but it's a very different protocol if the patient suffers hypotension or cardiac arrest, particularly cardiac surgery. And the recommendations are, if they're that unstable within 7 days, there's not even a question. If you're in the ICU, that patient will get a re-sternotomy at the bedside because the presumed diagnosis is tamponade. Now, in the emergency department, obviously, I don't know that most or any people would feel comfortable performing that open procedure, even getting it started. But what I would recommend is call the supply room, get a sternotomy tray either brought to the ED, or obviously as you're talking to your cardiac surgeon, express to them that your concern is that there's tamponade that you can't see. And you're thinking about all these other things that are in your diagnosis, but if they represent within a week, it has to be 1, 2, and 3 on your differential diagnosis. So if I'm performing that pericardiocentesis, I'm actually hoping that it's somewhat of a circumferential effusion, because the other thing is if I can't see an effusion on my ultrasound, I'm probably not all that comfortable doing it on my own and really just going to be thinking about what other bridging strategies do I have to resuscitate that patient in the meantime, which can be judicious fluid administration, blood product administration, maybe rapid reversal of any coagulopathy they have. So within the first 5 minutes, if I have a hypotensive patient who's recently had cardiac surgery, I'm calling the surgeons, letting them know they're there, and trying to really nail down a smaller differential diagnosis as much as possible.
Some great pearls there.
So I think this was an excellent review, guys. And Mike, you finished up with some great pearls, particularly about lung sliding or lack thereof, trying to avoid unnecessary chest tubes if possible in the patient with shortness of breath and no lung sliding. But ultimately, I think there's a few take-home points that hit me as we've gone through this article, as well as just the discussion, in that these patients are a real challenge, not just diagnostic, but therapeutic challenges. And they can present with a number of different causes of shock, whether it's tamponade causing obstructive shock, cardiogenic shock from heart failure, new onset sepsis, PE, all these things can be high up on your differential, at least right away. Critical physical exam components can definitely help narrow that differential, and particularly paying attention to the surgical site, taking a look at the sternum, feeling if there's any sternal mobility, redness, irritation. These things are all going to be really, really helpful as you start your management of this patient. Aside from the usual strategy for patients presenting with undifferentiated shock, careful attention should be made toward ruling out tamponade, graft occlusion, and surgical site infection. So at the end of the day, what am I going to do if that patient comes in after surgery, unstable, looking unwell? My general practice would be, number one, find out who did their surgery. Have the clerk get them on the phone to talk about any major concerns that they have, and come up with a plan about what we're going to do, which usually will involve fairly comprehensive lab testing, a rapid bedside ultrasound, and thinking about early CT scan of the chest. If the sternal incision doesn't look bad, considering looking for PE, which will also be helpful to identify a focal pericardial effusion that I'm not seeing on my bedside ultrasound. So this is some great take-home points and great pearls, guys. Thanks for going through that article with me.
John, that was outstanding. Rob, Peter, my thanks to you. That was a wonderful discussion on really a patient population that we're starting to see an uptick in terms of returning, and lots of patients as we are a little bit more aggressive in getting folks out of the hospital earlier. So some key pearls. By the time you listen to this podcast, it will be after Thanksgiving for those of you listening in the U.S. We certainly hope that you have had a wonderful holiday with family and friends, and certainly looking forward to the upcoming holiday season in December. Certainly all four of us are exceedingly thankful for you listening to the podcast each month. We love the dialogue back and forth, the questions that you send us, and we are certainly looking forward to closing 2018 and so many exciting things looking forward ahead on here on the podcast for 2019. We're going to close this podcast down for now. My thanks to John, Peter, and Rob for some outstanding pearls. We'll look forward to talking to you on our next podcast. Bye for now.